Today is Tuesday, April 10th, 2012. My name is Melissa Burlock, and I'm a public history graduate student at IUPUI. I will be interviewing Mr. Norris Lineweaver, who served as president and CEO of the YMCA of Greater Indianapolis from 1994 to 2005. We are going to discuss his executive leadership in relation to the Fall Creek Parkway YMCA branch.
Yeah, I have him spell his name.
Oh, yes, please do.
Norris, N-O-R-R-I-S. Lineweaver, L-I-N-E-W-E-A-V as in Victor, E-R.
Thank you.
This interview is part of the Fall Creek History Project. The project supervisor is Dr. Philip Scarpino, who is a history professor and director of the Graduate Public History Program at IUPUI. Mr. Lineweaver, I would like to ask your permission to do three things. Number one, to record this interview. Number two, to have the interview transcribed if we have the money to do so. And number three, to place the recording and the transcription in the IUPUI Archives and Special Collections and the YMCA of Greater Indianapolis, where they may be used by a variety of researchers and other interested parties. So do we have your permission to do all three of these things?
You have my permission to do all three.
Okay, great, thank you. So in your pre-interview, we briefly talked about the controversial close of Fall Creek's dormitories in 2002 and the demographic changes which preceded the close and sale of the facility in 2003. So for the next 2 hours, I want to talk more about this narrative, as well as how the YMCA of Greater Indianapolis responded to community concerns. And lastly, I would like to talk with you about the organizational structure of the YMCA and how this affected the Fall Creek branch. All right, and just to get it on record, the outline of the interview would be number one, closing the dormitories, number two, closing the facility, number three, communicating with the public, number four, selling the property, and number five, evaluating the organization. All of the documents mentioned in this interview, such as statements, newspaper articles, statistical reports, correspondence, and contracts, are mainly from two repositories. Number one being Room M in the English Foundation Building on 615 North Alabama Street, which is also where the YMCA of Greater Indianapolis is located in Suite 200. And number two, IUPUI's Indianapolis Recorder Digital Collection. So, and I also want to mention that I'll be using interchangeable abbreviations for the YMCA of Greater Indianapolis, including Greater Indianapolis YMCA, IYMCA, and the Metropolitan Association, and Metro. That's okay. So if I say all those things, I'm referring to the YMCA of Greater Indianapolis, just for the record. Okay. And so we're just going to begin the interview by me asking you a couple of questions so that we can have your answers on record. When and where were you born?
I was born in Portland, Oregon.
Okay. Right. When were you born?
May 19th, 1945.
So how was it like growing up in Portland during that
Actually,
time?
I didn't grow up in Portland.
Okay.
I was born there.
Right.
I spent 10 days of my entire life there.
Okay.
I was born to a Marine Corps family.
Okay.
And we moved around a lot. So, Yeah. I was reared as a child in mainland China.
Wow.
That's where I got this charming West Texas accent.
Right. Oh my gosh, so what was that experience like, kind of traveling and just being growing up in China?
You know, that's an interesting question. I was like other kids who belonged to military families. You get used to letting go and saying goodbye and learning how to make new friends.
Right.
And home was wherever we lived.
Right.
And so, you know, to say, you know, people talk about their roots.
Right.
You know, my roots were in a lot of different places, and I think it helped me as a child understand the concept of change.
Right.
And it's learning how to let go and go to new places and win new friends.
Right.
And so it was a very important part of who I am.
Right.
And to work for the YMCA is to work for a worldwide fellowship.
Right.
And if you commit yourself to the Y, it's you know, you never know where you're going to end up. I mean, my plan when I joined the Y, I never thought about coming to Indianapolis. It just sort of evolved.
So you earned a Bachelor of Science degree in Group Work Education and Recreation from George Williams College in 1967.
Yes.
So why did you decide to attend George Williams College?
Very good question. I grew up in West Texas.
Okay.
San Angelo Midland. Abilene is where I graduated from high school, 1963. And my father actually worked for the Y. And when he came home from the war, and he took his veterans benefits and went to Springfield College, which is the sister school of George Williams College. And he came back to my mother's homeland, Texas. My father grew up in Ohio. And my father brought with him his commitment to diversity because of his experience in the war and the values he grew up with in other parts of the country. And so for him to be involved in the Y, serving segregated communities, when I talk about segregation in the 50s, it was blatant. And make a long story short, my father was fired from the YMCA for basically busing kids from the other side of the tracks to come to swim at the Y because there was no swimming pool in their neighborhood. So that was a pivotal point in my career. I was at a very impressionable age. I felt no shame for my dad. In fact, he won a huge respect of my brothers and I for what he stood and believed in. And so that made an impression. And when I looked at schools that all my peers were going to, University of Texas, Texas A&M, Texas Tech, I looked at those schools, and I just didn't see a curriculum. I didn't see an experience that would help me get through that window my dad stood up for. So in the meantime, one of my high school buddies had gone to George Williams College and was writing me letters about what it was like going to school in Southside Chicago. And you're familiar with Chicago. Hyde Park, Kenwood communities, Saul Alinsky, the Black Muslim movement, Elijah Muhammad's temple. A lot of things were happening. And so I went to school. I went to undergraduate school in Southside Chicago. That was another turning point in my life. So the reason I went there was to have, you know, when you go to college, you should have a new experience. But in between high school and college was the military. And I went to basic training at Fort Polk, Louisiana. And the company I trained with in the infantry, most of them were white. In fact, there was only one black in our entire company, Calvin from Houston. And most of the guys I trained with were National Guard from Alabama and been manning fire hoses for 18 months. And Calvin couldn't take it. He did something very violent, and he went AWOL. And he was brought back to the company while we were bivouacking out in the swamps. And I was asked to be his guard. I was given a pistol. As a soldier, I did what the soldier was supposed to do. But it was just Calvin and I. It was dark of midnight, and he and I had a chance to talk. I knew when the Army issued me a 45, it was not loaded. Okay. They don't give soldiers in training a loaded rifle unless you're out on the rifle range. I knew it wasn't loaded. Mm-hmm. Calvin, I think, knew it wasn't loaded. But Calvin asked, said, "What if I just get up and run? What are you going to do?" And my only answer to Calvin was, "Calvin, I don't know if my pistol is loaded or not, so let's just not even try." That was a moment of truth for me. And then, after that, I was assigned to a very different company. These were young men from Harlem. I was the only white. I mean, the shift was unbelievable. And the experience of being a white minority for the first time in my life. I was Army Reserve. All these young men were draftees. They were going to Vietnam. I was going to come to Chicago and go to college. Another chapter in my life that made an impression. And I stood outside when these men were loaded on their buses to say goodbye to them. And walked back into an empty barracks. And it gave me time to think and reflect about what's going on in our society and the changes that were taking place. At the time, I couldn't even comprehend. It was just experience. And then, once I was separated from the Army, came to Southside Chicago. I think that transition from a segregated community to the realities of what was happening in the world through the Army, and then going to Southside Chicago inside of 6 months was a leap, a fast track to a very different reality and experience. I don't know if it hadn't been for that military experience, if I would have survived my first introduction to Southside Chicago. But I felt a sense of confidence that this is a chapter I need to go through to learn what it means to be a white minority in a black majority. And through that, hopefully some insight in terms of what it means to be a black minority in a white majority.
So why did you decide to major in group work, education, and recreation?
Because it was the curriculum to prepare for a career in the YMCA. Okay. You either went through group work, education, and recreation, or you went through health and physical education. And my interest was in community organization leadership. And I knew at that time, if you could bring children together who learned to play with each other in an extraordinary experience, that set their minds in terms of what the possibilities when they start to work and who they're prepared to work with. And so I chose that curriculum.
Mm-hmm. So after graduating from George Williams, you were employed as a World Service Worker at the YMCA of Ethiopia between
yes.
September 1967 and June 1969.
Yes.
So what was that experience like? Why did you decide to go to Addis Ababa to Ethiopia?
Well, I'll tell you, there were members of my family who thought I was committing suicide just coming to Southside Chicago, and here I am going off to the Horn of Africa. There's a part of my extended family who are missionaries in North Korea and India, and I was just sort of infatuated with the notion of, while you're young and have no family, why not pursue these adventures and see what you can do in that part of the world. George Williams College, we had international students, and there was one student by the name of Desta Gurma who was from Ethiopia. And he and I got to know each other. When the opportunity came up to sign up, it was, the World Service was the precursor to the Peace Corps. In fact, the Peace Corps patterned a lot of its structure after the YMCA World Service Worker Program, the notion that you get a fresh college student to commit to a couple of years on a stipend. And for me, that was $50 a month plus room and board. $50 a month plus room and board. Now, $50 mm-hmm. above and beyond room and board, fresh out of college, mm-hmm. I would say my colleagues who stayed here in the U.S., and we're making $10,000 a year, which was sort of that was the top end of starting pay in the Y, you know, if you graduated in 67. And so $50 went a long way in Ethiopia. I mean, when you do the currency exchange rate, but I saved it. I actually walked away with $500 in my pocket after 2 years, because I knew I needed a head start when I came back home. So I did it because I just felt the passion to do something different again. Mm-hmm. And again, with no hesitation to realize that I was walking into another situation of being a white minority and a black majority. And to prepare myself for coming back home to make a difference.
At the YMCA?
Yes.
So you also attended the University of Texas Urban Institute.
Yes.
As a John R. Mott Fellow between 1975 and 1977. Mm-hmm. And you completed graduate studies in urban and regional planning, as well as criminal justice reform. So how did that education in particular prepare you for your very distinguished 43-year nonprofit management career?
Well, 7 years in the field, you know, in the actual reality of practice, overseas in Africa and later in Dallas, Texas, I began to realize that things were happening in the community from a systemic, you know, the system, you know. In the 60s, we talked about the system. And I wanted to learn more about how decisions were made and how policy that was being developed that set the stage for development, how that impacted right down to the street in terms of behavior of kids and so forth and so on, and which we'll talk later about what was happening here in Indianapolis and in the Fall Creek Y bit being at the center of that emotional change that took place. That urban policy was really a curriculum that was really quite new. And I knew it was going to be different than going to a school of social work, because schools of social work really focus more on casework, one-on-one. And I have a lot of respect for people who go into that field of work. But if and to change people's lives is very, very noble. But I sensed that, for me, I wanted to affect change in terms of how policies were being developed and what role could the Y play to influence policy, urban policy. So that's the reason why I chose that field of work.
So let's talk about why you came to Indianapolis to become president and CEO of the Greater Indianapolis YMCA. So you assumed the position in 1994 and retired from that position in 2005. What attracted you to Indianapolis in the first? I mean, why did you want to come here to assume that position and be mm-hmm. over a YMCA over the greater Indianapolis area?
Well, I concluded my watch here in Indianapolis in 05, but actually I didn't retire till 09. So
okay,
in between 05 and 09, I was the director general of the YMCA in Jerusalem,
okay.
Israel. I had planned to retire in Indianapolis. So in a way, there's a truth to what you said. It was certainly my intent, but I was called to Jerusalem.
Okay.
We can maybe talk about that later, but I was with the Houston YMCA when I had an opportunity, and I did apply for the vacancy that happened with the retirement of Will Peck, who had served here for 19 years, and I was honored to be selected as a finalist and offered the position, and I accepted. And so I come here in 04. And I'm sorry, 1994. Mm-hmm. And it was at that time when I came with my wife and daughter, I began to realize that this was a city that was rediscovering itself. I mean, quite literally. Downtown, the Circle Center Mall were ramparts being braced by steel structures holding up the original facades. Until they could build the infrastructure so that they were sustaining, in a sense, the historical edifices. But in between, something remarkable was about to happen. And the only restaurant that we were advised to go to was San Elmo's. That was in 1994. There were few other choices at the time. And so, but I realized, I just could sense that this was a city that was rediscovering itself, and that excited me. That really motivated me. And I was excited to come to Indianapolis. I really was. I was ready for it.
When you became president and CEO, what were your goals for the organization? What were your goals for the YMCA of Greater Indianapolis?
Well, not so much my goals as the very clear goals of the board of directors. When I was interviewed, there was a panel sitting around a table of some five members of the board. And by the way, a diverse group. And there were 25 questions in that final interview, 25. And they addressed five major areas of concern in terms of future direction. And I listened very carefully to those questions. In fact, I was so thrilled with the quality of the questions that I could recall all 25 of them. I wrote them down after the interview and sent a follow-up letter to the search committee, said, here are the questions that you asked, and here are a summary that if I missed the answer, this is what I intended to answer. I would recommend that to anybody who's looking for employment at this level of responsibility. But I didn't do it to impress the search committee. I did it because if I were selected, I knew that those were the 25 most important questions facing the future of the Y in the community. And some of those questions dealt with my commitment to diversity and what would I do to help encourage diversity within the Y. And I took those questions in the context of the interview process, not really knowing the implications in terms of facts on the ground, because I've never been to Indianapolis before. I'm completely fresh. And so I, in a way, I come in with insight because of the questions being asked by the board, but I was very naive to knowing the community. So I come in with a very fresh outlook, with a passion for taking direction from the board, because if I were to ask questions in moving my family all the way across country to a community I've never been in before, these would be the questions that would fire up my heart and passion. And so my goals were the goals of the board, and that was, at the time, there was a perception that even though the name of the organization was YMCA of Greater Indianapolis, there was a strong mindset that we really only is the YMCA of Marion County. And the notion that suburbs can take care of themselves. Right, and I, from Houston, my God, how do you define the city of Houston? I mean, it's sprawl. I mean, it's like Los Angeles. It just grows and grows and grows and grows, and there's nothing in its way. And so, to move from one community to the next and actually look at, well, here's the boundary of the county, Harris County, it's blurred. I mean, it was just continued rooftops and businesses stretching out around. And this is the story of Indianapolis, is it's not just Marion County. It's because of Marion County that we have these suburban communities that you know, you don't know when you cross Marion County boundary. And so my commitment was to realize a vision of being the YMCA of Greater Indianapolis, but not forgetting where we began. And that's the inner city. And so on the one hand, my responsibility was to reflect a vision of nurturing and doing the right thing for the future of the inner city, at the same time answering to the needs and invitations of families with children who wanted us to be more convenient and present for them and the outlying communities.
So how would you describe as the developmental direction of the YMCA, what the board hoped, how the board wanted the YMCA to develop, while you were as president and executive director? So you mentioned a couple of things, like they wanted to be, you know, maybe more diverse, and that you wanted to make sure that it kind of expanded to outlying areas. So It's like, how did you see the YMCA developing in the future? Or how did the board see the YMCA developing into the future? Was diversity a key issue? Or was,
well, there were things happening that spelled opportunity. And I can describe three of those because they touch on inner city, transition communities, and the outlying suburbs. There was a so-called riot that took place at 42nd and College. I say so-called because when I think of a riot, I think of those I experienced overseas in Ethiopia, in Chicago, and out in Los Angeles, where it was just mayhem and chaos everywhere, and mass destruction of property. There was an altercation involving a youth on the street and the police at 42nd and College that brought the attention of the community and the mayor's office and so forth to that particular neighborhood that went through a lot of change, 42nd and College. Today there's a library there at 42nd and College, and there's a little bit of a story there. But the history since the transition from Sinan Avenue to Fall Creek, the history of the YMCA here in Indianapolis did not really have a very well defined or articulated, when I say articulate, I mean in depth, alignment of programs and the needs of the community in the inner city. The downtown Y closed. What was the date? It became the parking lot for the new AUL building. In order for the AUL building to rise above the ground, there was insufficient capacity in their underground parking and they needed parking elsewhere. And so the downtown Y sold in order to make room for the development of the AUL tower. And it's called today One America Plaza or something. So the downtown Y had a history of outreach. And as I looked at that history, it was relatively unremarkable compared to my knowledge of how YMCA's developed urban programs elsewhere. And so the board was operating in the context of not having the experience of successful programs in the inner city and concerned that there was a lack of success embodied by the Fall Creek YMCA. It had not captured the same level of imagination and programming that people remember the Senate Avenue Y. And so the board was operating in that context and knew that what we were doing and where most of the funds were being invested wasn't fulfilling what people felt those investment dollars should be doing in the lives of kids in the community. So there was that, and so they said, well, why not 42nd and College? So the first thing I'm doing is I'm trying to figure out, is there a possibility of establishing a new urban YMCA at 42nd and College? And it didn't take me long to figure out that the footprint available was even worse than the footprint that was allocated for the Fall Creek Y. It was going to be doomed to fail from the beginning. So basically, what people's vision, including Mayor Goldsmith at that time, about having a YMCA there, we would no longer have altercations between the youth and police. It was sort of the symbol, but you know, the rallying call. And the Meridian Kessler Community Development really questioned the efficacy of having a Y there. And there was the historical preservationist. They wanted us, if we're going to use the Masonic Lodge, that we would not renovate it. And it's right there, curbside, no open green space. It just really wasn't an ideal location. And this is when I became very involved and introduced to the Black leadership of the community. And one of them was Joe Simpson. He and I had hours of discussion, heart to heart, just he and I. And Joe really turned my mind around in terms of what the Y should really focus in terms of really responding to the needs of the community. And so the 42nd and College was a false start. I mean, unfortunately, we spent a lot of money and so forth doing feasibility studies and design concepts, even a design concept of a joint YMCA library. You walk into the lobby, you go over here to the library, and you go over here to join the Y, and the library was even saying, you know, we can do waterproof books. So kids can go in, check out a book, and go for a float in the pool and read. I mean, we're coming up with a lot of creative ideas, but it was just too much for a small footprint. And so we withdrew, and so the library could move ahead with their vision for that. And so in a way, we made a contribution to that neighborhood by focusing resources there and putting our support behind the library. But moved on to other opportunities that were emerging at the time. In the meantime, Fall Creek was still a source of pain and frustration for people who were trying to get their arms around it. In effect, when we say lost revenues, what was happening at the time, and another vision for the board, was to strengthen our relationship with the United Way. There was tension between, a dynamic tension between the United Way and the YMCA. And as I opened up dialogue and personally sought out individuals, both on the board of the United Way and the key staff of the United Way, what I learned was there was a perception of the YMCA that it was totally irrelevant to the inner city. And we were turning blacks away at our suburban branches. Oh, if you want financial assistance, you need to go to the Fall Creek Y. And when I learned that, I began to realize change needed to start within the culture of the organization. And it was blatant racism, but it's what I call institutional racism, not necessarily free will of the individual. It was just a naive notion that if all of our subsidies are going to the Fall Creek Y and you want a scholarship, then you go apply at the Fall Creek Y. And my statement to every suburban branch exec or all the execs was, if you have a family that shows up at your front desk, you own them. I don't care if they're black, white, purple, green, red, they are your future members. And that took a lot of intense work right there. And that was my work in 94, 95, and 96. Because as I reached out and sought people in the community, they finally loosened up with me and told me what was going on. And then I had to exercise my responsibility as a CEO to move in incrementally to change the culture of the YMCA. Because what I began to realize is that with the inter-district order of the federal court for the desegregation of schools, you would expect then a natural out-migration from the inner city to what parents perceived as better opportunities for education of their children. And so if we're going to serve folk, our outlying centers became more convenient for them. Why would they want to go all the way down to the Fall Creek Y? It doesn't make any sense. And so we had to change the culture from within to take advantage of what was already taking place. So strengthening the relationship with the United Way created other requirements, because the United Way itself was going through change. Instead of just making an allocation to the agency and letting the agency decide how to use those funds, the United Way began to set requirements that we're no longer making allocations to agencies, we're going to make allocations to programs that respond to a defined need, and you will be evaluated how effective you were in resolving that need in the community. So it's being accountable to end results, okay? And this exposed any weakness that we had at any of our program centers, including Fall Creek. Just because you're the Fall Creek YMCA and receiving this allocation, you're no longer, as long as you rely upon more subsidies, then there's a higher degree of accountability than branches who do not require subsidies for their operation. And so that created internally a conflict. Why should we, Fall Creek, be more accountable than Randsburg or other branches in the association? Mm-hmm. And my response was, is because you are receiving more subsidies that require that. And therefore, we are going to work with you to help you respond to that level of accountability. This is a new, that was a dramatic change. And what we began to realize was a lot of exposure of the overhead of the building itself that required subsidies that was becoming more difficult for us to raise above and beyond the United Way. The United Way wasn't interested in underwriting the overhead of a building. They were only interested in providing subsidies targeting specific human need in the community and being held accountable for it.
So after, I guess, negating institutional racism and receiving, you know, subsidies from United Way, and this was between 1994 and 1996, your first 2 years working as president and CEO, is that correct? So even after these efforts, the Fall Creek YMCA closed in 2003. And so just before discussing the demographic reports and sort of the public media controversy surrounding the close and sale of the Fall Creek YMCA, I want to ask you just to please summarize why you made the decision to close the branch. And you've already touched on some of those issues, but just a quick.
Well, I came in 94, and you know, the board was taking me around to visit various sites, and I had heard there was a problem with the Fall Creek Y. And when I was taken to the Fall Creek Y, I was expecting a dilapidated building and, you know, surrounded by blight and so forth and so on. And I was amazed at what I saw. First impression, I got excited. I said, this is the Y that's in the middle of great opportunity. So, you know, I'm coming fresh, naive, and so forth, and didn't know the history. So my first impulse was, I can make this Y hum. I don't know what the problem is. And as I became more involved in the community, I began to realize that that location it fell to the powers of what was happening in the community. And there were found out later, years later, that there was actually a covenant agreement between the community, the black leadership of the community, and IUPUI, thou shall not cross 10th Street. Well, where is the why? I mean, I was naively thinking, geez, you know, if the residence is not full, and you've got all these students looking for housing at IUPUI, why don't we become the housing solution to advance higher education? And we met with the director of housing, IUPUI, and so forth. And I thought we were going to make headway, and this was going to be fantastic. And then all of a sudden, discussion stopped. And I couldn't figure out why. Why do we have a dead end here? This was before I understood about 10th Street being that demarcation. And, you know, the housing director said, you know, higher up said, we need to look in another direction. We can't go that way. Then we focused our attention on Wishart Hospital. You know, we're in the business of promoting health and wellness. Why don't we partner with Wishart Hospital? And Wishart actually came over and looked at our facility, and we looked at creative ways in which we could add on to the facility to increase capacity. Why would Wishart do it? Because they had developed some prevention programs, health prevention programs, particularly for the elderly. And it was taking up space that was becoming more viable to Wishart to actually take care of their tertiary, I mean their, what do you call it? It's more medical urgent needs. And so that's when we learned that the structural design of the building itself created a lot of obstacles for renovation and even additions. It's cantilever style construction. It was the least expensive form at that time, and which means cantilever means the support beams are inside the envelope of the building. And so when you create your as opposed to the outside envelope, and the difference that architects told me is in terms of the structural integrity of the building, it limits what you can do with the partitioning on the inside when you're cantilever. Okay. And so even student housing, they wanted to know if we could break up the partitioning in the dormitories. And we found that that was going to be, and could we air condition? And when you look at the photos of the actual demolition of the Fall Creek Y, it's proof positive of the partitioning of the building itself, the walls were weight-bearing. And so you couldn't just knock out a wall without putting expensive cross beams. And the distance, the span between the floor and the ceiling was set in concrete. You know, 7 feet, so many, it wasn't even quite 8 feet. So there was not enough room to put in air conditioning appurtenances to update the building, unless you put these ugly boxes on outside the windows, and then you have a very inefficient building and more expensive to operate even. And so if we couldn't modify or renovate to make the building less expensive to operate, then why would you invest capital to go that move in that direction? So Wishard and the discussions with Wishard led us to believe and understand that we had a real problem with the structure of the building itself and the very limited footprint upon which it sat. It required us to bifurcate the parking, which is a no-no when you're trying to define convenience and access. And the largest amount of the parking was actually on the resident side and not on the side in which we were signing up members for in terms of promoting health and fitness. So the structure of the property, it had a triangular, and you know, the requirements for building a Y for the future is minimum 10 acres. 10 acres. And we had just a little over 2 acres there. And it was triangular shaped and very, very difficult to figure out how we could bring that Y into the 21st century from a building standpoint without spending an enormous amount of funds. And so we knew that the fathers of philanthropy, the fathers and mothers of philanthropy in the community just weren't going to respond to any case to further invest in that. We were, the Fall Creek Y was the last residence, YMC residence in the entire state of Indiana. And so it was taking up a lot of our energies in terms of managing the only residence we had. And to capture that intellectual capital and to invest in SRO, single resident occupancy housing, which was a viable need, no question about it, a viable need in that area. Most of our residents were entry-level employers for IUPI and the hospital and so forth. And once they got settled into their positions, they would move out after 3 months and then others would come in. So we were responding to a need. It was difficult for us to return a contribution to the overhead with only 90 rooms and without air conditioning. And it was doomed to fail from the very beginning. And so, you know, that's the before picture in terms of the decision. I came in with excitement and passion. I can make this Y work. And began to realize the obstacles, both in the community and a decision that was made to move there to begin with. It was doomed to fail from the beginning.
A question about the community. So the Fall Creek YMCA opened in 1959 to serve a segregated African-American community. So by the time you became president and CEO in 1994, did you see any role for a predominantly black YMCA? Did you see any role for a YMCA that served specifically black YMCA, regardless of the demographics or the feasibility of it? Do you think it was important to have a Y that served specifically black families and black children?
There was a need, historically, for a YMCA that served people of color. That was the term used historically, people of color. There was a need for that because basically YMCAs were built at a time when blacks were not welcome, and blacks knew that, so don't even bother to go there. That's the dark period of the YMCA. And in fact, nationally, there was a special department, Service to People of Color, and they focused on building separate but equal facilities around the country, and they had philanthropists lined up. Julius Rosenthal of Chicago was best known for his generosity to provide the seed money if the local community raised the money to build a YMCA serving people of color. So we start with that history. And remarkable stories of how important these Ys were to communities that were predominantly black. I come in 1994, I see the reality of an inter-district order which encouraged an out-migration from the inner city, and I saw opportunities of integrating branches that were not integrated as what I'd like for them to be or see, or reflecting what was going on in the community. And so my focus was bringing people together, not creating another institution that kept them apart. Yet at the same time, I saw communities that were predominantly black. So obviously, if we find a way to position ourselves in those communities, it's understood that the majority of constituents would be black participants. But to build a building with major capital with the intent that it would continue to serve predominantly black community was not a part of my vision. And it wasn't the vision of major philanthropy that we would have to depend upon either, because their vision and desire was to create a opportunities for uniting the community. And is there efficacy in major capital? And the question I raised, I said, let's say we had $20 million to build a YMCA with the intent that it'd be predominantly black. Tell me where you'd put it. I mean, that was the question I posed. Where would you put it? And because when I looked at the demographics of the movement that was taking place, there was not one intersection that any longer was going to be the center of the black community, because it was dispersing almost laterally west to east. And so I was looking, when I was looking at the conversion of facilities at Fort Bend, I saw an opportunity for us to be at the center of a new integrated community. I was looking at how could we serve more African-American families, not less. How can we serve more? And we had existing locations. Southside, if you look at the demographics, there was very little out-migration to the Southside. Southside is still predominantly white, even to this day. But when we looked at positions of expansion to the east and the west, and Pike Township, where we had no Y facility at all, then that was the vision, that was the challenge before the board. There's not one YMCA, but several YMCs looking into the future and positioning to be sure they were located to unite the community. Okay? Fort Bend is a vivid example. You go out there today, and because the bridge that was built across Pendleton Pike, or the railroad tracks from Pendleton Pike, the 56th Street corridor, that was the opportunity to unite a predominantly black neighborhood on the east side with other neighborhoods that were integrated but predominantly white. But they were integrated because of the influence of the military and formerly Western Electric. To have an integrated YMCA from the start, you go out there today, we're serving more African-American families at Fort Bend than we were only could dream about at Fall Creek. And so we entertain that question. Should we develop another YMCA with the intent that it continue to be predominantly black to address the black agenda? And we made a determination that's not the role of the YMCA. Keep in mind, when Senate Avenue was created, there was no Urban League, there was no NAACP, you know, our Center for Leadership Development. In the meantime, there are institutions that are doing very good work, focused primarily on the needs of the black community. And should the YMCA create another position that would compete with the interest of those excellent organizations, or should we take a position that unites the surrounding communities and then focus our strategy on then what should be our role in Center Township? Because as we looked at Center Township, you have to face the reality that we have divided communities from a structural standpoint. It's the apex of interstate highways coming into the city. Why are we called the Crossroads of America? We have more interstate connections in our city than any other metropolitan area in the United States of America. But the cost of that are these huge concrete asphalt that create barriers that over time separate neighborhoods. And so in order for us to better serve the inner city, we needed to be strategically located in a variety of different locations. And there just wasn't philanthropy that was going to help us capitalize. But we began to recognize there were capital assets that were already there. They're called schools. And so, for instance, we established a strong presence at IPS 14, Washington Irving School, on the Near East Side. IPS 60, and they had available space where we could establish a presence. And our focus was before and after school, with the kids. Let's talk about social capital. The YMCA thrives and lives on social capital. It's not just philanthropy. Social capital. What is social capital? For us, the definition of social capital is parent initiative to enroll. Those were the first families to leave Center Township, by the way. They took the initiative to move to perceived higher quality education. That was social capital. They picked up their roots and moved their children to what they perceive to be an opportunity for a better life. And this has not just happened here in Indianapolis, it's happened in cities around the country, is that you had a change in social capital. There were rooftops right next to the Fall Creek Y who never took the initiative to enroll at the Y. Even if we reached out to them and said, "You're welcome," which we did, they just didn't take the initiative to enroll for whatever reasons. It's not peculiar just Indianapolis. This was, a dialogue with leaders around the country on this very issue. And I forget the author of Bowling Alone. It's a classic piece in terms of the change of the civic nature of America. And he defines social capital as initiative to enroll. Initiative to enroll in Rotary Club and service clubs and Optimus and so forth. These are defining places in our community where men and women gather to do civic good for the community. And that's the history of the Senate Avenue YMCA. The civic good, it was the center of civic good for the African American community. And as the communities changed, social capital began to disperse. Why? Because they could. They could afford to do it, number one. Number two, there was a more of an open acceptance of blacks moving into neighborhoods that heretofore were predominantly white and thou shalt not even drive through it. That was changing. And so the reason we went to schools is because the parents didn't have to necessarily take the initiative to enroll. And we knew that if we were going to rely upon parent initiative to enroll, we were dead in the water. I mean, there are efforts in this community in preparation for the opening day of school that some of the homeless shelters and outreach staff, including our staff, would go out to the homeless shelters to make sure children were coming to school to enroll. Parents didn't even know it was the opening day of school. That's what I mean by social capital. And so by being there already in the school, we could capture the kids that were there. We were a partner with the public schools to basically provide a solution because the kids had no place to go to after school, literally. So it made more economic sense for us to place qualified staff that were trained to actually establish a presence of the YMCA right there on the school grounds. During my watch, we had as many as 118 after-school centers throughout Indianapolis, including the inner city. So that was our strategy, to be in more places rather than just one, and to take advantage of existing capital that's already in place rather than encumber or burden the community of donating for capitalization of one location. It just didn't make sense.
So I just want to mention for the record that materials related to the first African-American YMCA General Secretary who spearheaded the Black YMCA movement in the late 1880s, as well as other materials related to leaders involved in establishing Black YMCAs, which we kind of touched on. All those materials are housed at the YMCA archives, which are in the Elmer L. Anderson Library of the University of Minnesota. So that's for the record.
Yes.
So we talked about the community. I want to just go back to talking about the structure and talk about closing the dormitories and how the structure of the dormitories related to why they were closed. So I concluded from newspaper articles that the close of Fall Creek's, was it 97 rooms, 90 or 90?
Yeah, yeah. I think it was more like 99 rooms, and
okay, 99.
So two of the rooms were in service. I mean, they just...
Right.
We couldn't rent them. They're leaking and so forth. And
okay.
So 97, I believe,
right.
Is correct. Yeah.
Okay. So I concluded from newspaper articles that the close of Fall Creek's dormitory section was really the first major controversy.
Yeah. Yes.
Concerning the why that occurred during your tenure as president and CEO. So could you describe Metro's credibility and relationship with the Black community members, following the close of the YMCA dormitories? And that happened on March 29, 2002. So could you describe Metro's credibility within the Black community even after all of the residents were successfully transitioned to another location? How was Metro's credibility?
When you ask, what was our perception of credibility of the Y in the Black community?
Mm-hmm.
We were very aware that we were, you know, limited credibility to a high level of credibility, depending on who we talked to in the African American community. And we understood at the time that those who perceived a lack of credibility were still locked in the emotions of what was happening in the community at large, and it wasn't just about the why. The why reflected what was going on in the community. And we were learning not to take that personally and make stupid decisions as a result of perceived levels of lack of credibility. We knew that there were a lot of questions. And so we thought very carefully, and the reason that we closed the residence at the time is that we didn't want any victims of closure of that residence to fall victim to the larger issue of closing the Y itself.
Okay.
And so we did that in advance in order to make sure that every resident, there were 78 residents at that time, and I worked with Lavester Hobbs to make sure every one of those men had a place to go to. And it came down to 12 who didn't have a place to go to. Those 12 had prison records, that was getting in the way of even getting into housing, much less a job. Well, we found out most of them had jobs, okay? The issue was a landlord not accepting felons into their facility. So I told Lavester, I said, I'll write a personal letter of commendation for each of those 12 men based on their work history after leaving prison, showing up to work on time, da 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 da, and if they needed the first and last month's rent in order to qualify to get into housing, we were going to cover that for them.
Well, after a quick break, we're going to talk more about the community reaction to what Metro did.